You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, January 5th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Donald Cohen, founder and executive director of In the Public Interest, author, The Privatization of Everything, How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America and How We Can Fight Back. Co-written with Alan McHalion. Also on the program today, surprise! Joe Manchin throws cold water on meaningful filibuster reform for voting rights. Labor Department reports a record 4.2 million people quit their crappy job in November. Trump cucked. Cancels his January 6th event because his handlers are afraid people will tune in. Meanwhile, disgraced former Governor Andrew Cuomo will not be prosecuted for groping by the Albany, New York DA. Sean Hannity asked to cooperate with the January 6th hearings after a massive release of his text messages to Mark Meadows. Thousands of Florida teachers and students out sick with Omicron. Chicago teachers vote to stay home today. Across the border, Canada will pay $31.5 billion to fix and compensate Indigenous victims of Canada's welfare system for First Nation children. And the DNC staff unionizes. Customs and Border Patrol to review a secret division they apparently have that has been spying on journalists and Congress members. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us today. We've got a lot to get to. It is Wednesday, of course. Emma is not here with us today. Emma Vigeland is out this week. But in her honor, I will note that it is hump day. First week back, we're in the midst of a massive Omicron surge. One correction or clarification. I'm not even sure I got this wrong yesterday, but that is how scrupulous. What's the word I'm looking for, Matt?
I think scrupulous works.
Okay, thank you. I am providing you the most accurate of information. I got a tweet that suggested that yesterday I said that there was no spike in hospitalizations from Omicron. There is a spike. It appears not to be commensurate with the size of the spike in infections. However, and I hope I've been clear on this, you can have, let's just say for the sake of argument, 100 infections and a 5% hospitalization rate, right, where you would get 5 people hospitalized for every 100 infections. But even if you have a 3% hospitalization rate, but you have 1,000 infections or 600 infections, because Omicron is that much more contagious, you're still going to get a lot of people in the hospital. And certainly the problem we have, and we've seen numbers go up consistently in hospitalizations, it's always a lagging indicator, but the sense is that with Omicron, things move a little quicker than they did with the prior iterations of COVID. And I've been saying, I guess, really for a month about Omicron's that I suspect we're going to start to see some hospital failures and system failures around the country. And I still expect that we're going to see that as a function of the Omicron surge. I mean, it is everywhere. In New York, it's just it's completely nuts right now. In Florida, apparently, there were thousands of teachers who were out because of illness yesterday, as well as students. I know this is the case. I've got two kids who go to public school in New York City, and their class size is about half of what it normally is. My son, his teacher is out. His principal is out. My daughter says that there are teachers and students out. And I gave my daughter the option of going to school or not. And it was really on the, you know, and just for this week. Or not the entire week, but I mean, just the past couple of days, I should say. Today, in Chicago, public school officials canceled classes because they're having a fight with the teachers' union, whose members had threatened to stay home to force instruction online during this surge because Chicago is not providing the safety protocols that the teachers feel that they need. They have a shortage of tests. They don't have universal vaccination rate amongst the students. There's a bunch of staff members calling in sick. And what we're seeing in the media and in other quarters is this unbelievable reaction to what's going on in Chicago. Let me be clear. My son's in there today. He's got a substitute teacher. Half the kids are missing. He's not learning anything. The teacher's going to have to, when the teacher comes back, the teacher's going to have to go back over this. I mean, he's not in there for education at this point. He's in there because, A, I feel particularly in his school, he's going to be safe. And I got nowhere else to put him. I could sit him in this office right now and he'd be sitting there watching, you know, something on YouTube or something. But that's the bottom line. The point is that when you have teachers out sick, this many, and when you have this many students who are not coming in because their parents are worried about COVID, or maybe they have COVID, or maybe the kids have COVID, there's no education going on in these schools. So let's be honest here with why we want these schools opened at this moment, or not remote. That is because there are people out there who want there to be business, want business to take place. They want to get into work or whatever. They want to deal with it. This is not anybody who's out there saying right now that you can't keep school kids home from school, you know, this week when there's a surge going on, which everyone predicts is going to be short lived because of the nature of this variant. And they're talking about education. They're full of it. Here is not necessarily Exhibit A, but one of the exhibits. Play this. This is Morning Joe.
If you don't want to teach, don't teach. Yeah. Quit. Just stay at home and stop teaching children, okay?
Or,
because when you set up that barrier to getting back to class, when healthcare officials say that you can still
hold
be
on,
testing
hold
positive
on for
30
a
days
hold on
after.
For a second, pause it. It sounds weird to me. It sounds almost like Joe's not in a studio. Like he's in a more makeshift studio, it sounds like. Because the sound isn't quite as dead as it is when he's in studio. And why is there that bar in between the two of them? I mean, give me a break. None of these people are in studio. Give me a break. I wonder why that might be. Continue.
Well, you obviously, if that's your standard, you're either ignorant when it comes to science, or you just don't want to be in classes. And if you don't want to be in classes, that's fine. Listen, thank you for your service to our children. Now go get another job.
So in response to the...
I mean, this is just absurd. Yeah, teachers, they don't want to teach. They go in it for the lucrative pay and the respect that they get from society. I mean, it really is unbelievable. Going through a surge that like we haven't seen before, really. I mean, maybe since the very beginning. All of the schools probably should have been remote this week. They should have anticipated it. But the idea that this is about, you know, teaching the kids. No, it's not. It's about warehousing the kids for a couple of days. And, you know, it's perfectly reasonable that some people might say, I'm a little concerned about catching COVID. Maybe the chances of me dying are not as high as they were. We're not sure about long haul.
Maybe we should raise taxes on people like Joe Scarborough so we can pay teachers more for the hazard that they're putting themselves in.
That's one way of doing it. Maybe we could pour more resources into it. Maybe we could pay for people to stay at home during this week so that we wouldn't have this intense need to warehouse the kids. I mean, and believe me, I want my kids at school. I want my kids at school so that I'm not sitting on the couch here, but I want my kids at school because I want them to learn. So I'm sensitive to this issue. But I have no idea what's going on in Chicago schools. And I can see the distance, the difference between what's going on in my son's school and my daughter's school. And that's in the same school system. So it's really sort of stunning to watch. And really, in many respects, this is a failure of the Biden administration in not being aggressive enough in getting tests into the hands of people, not setting protocols. We should be testing far more people as they go in. People should be there should be tests everywhere. Like candy bars. It should be to get a test in this country. We will we'll be talking to Donald Cohen, who is the founder and ED of the In the Public Interest, author of Privatization of Everything, How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America, and How We Can Fight Back, in just a moment. But first, a message from our sponsor, and also, actually, a, what would you call this? A piece of software, I guess, that we use. You may run a business. Well, you can supercharge your knowledge, your sales, and your success with Shopify. It's the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big businesses. So upstarts, startups, podcasts, and established businesses alike can sell everywhere, synchronize online and in-person sales, and effortlessly stay informed. Shopify powers millions of businesses from first sale to full scale. You can reach customers online and across social networks with an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps. That includes Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, and more. Plus, you gain insights as you grow. You get a sense, where am I selling this? What's selling on this site as opposed to that site? Gives you detailed reporting of conversion rates, profit margins, and beyond. It's more than a store. Shopify grows with you. This is possibility. It is powered by Shopify. Now, for us, we have a fairly straightforward, you know, what would you call it? Like a side hustle? I don't know that we're making that much money on the store. It's not a big, money maker for us. We never tried for it, but it's really super easy for us to use. And it gives us an opportunity to sell our merch, have a sense of what's selling, what's not. We can play around with different things, get a sense of what, if we want to push the scarves as opposed to the pencils. But you can check it out at shop.majorityreportradio.com. It's been extremely helpful for us. And for you, you can go to Shopify.com/majority, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial. Get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to Shopify.com/majority right now. Shopify, Shopify.com/majority. Check it out. All right. I want to welcome to the program Donald Cohen. He is the founder and the executive director of In the Public Interest, author of The Privatization of Everything, which he co-wrote with Alan McCallion. It is The Privatization of Everything, How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America, and How We Can Fight Back. Donald, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I enjoy your show.
Oh, well, thank you. I enjoyed your book. And in this topic, I still, and you write about this, but I remember covering the 2008 privatization of the Chicago parking meters. And in many respects, this has been sort of the biggest go-to. Why don't we just start with that as an anecdote, and then we'll get into sort of some of the broader themes.
Yeah, it's a real cautionary tale. Right. So let's make sure people know what we're talking about. 2008, 2009, the Great Recession, cities are bleeding red ink. And that's the context. On a Friday, if you live in Chicago, you remember Mayor Daley at the time unveiled a proposal from a private consortium made up of Morgan Stanley, a sovereign wealth fund from the Middle East, and a national parking company, that they would give the city $1.1 billion up front. Remember, the city's bleeding, right? Like every city, in exchange for the city's control of the city's 36,000 parking meters for 75 years. Vote on Tuesday. Okay. Desperation. Also, you could speculate on the why, but no scrutiny, no diligence. They did the deal. Okay. So, after the fact, they learned, the inspector general and other folks sort of looked at it and analyzed it. And two things were true. One was it's an incredibly stupid way to borrow money on your future parking meter, returns. I mean, everybody borrows money on their future income, but 75 years, we don't know if we're going to be driving. Right. Even if it was the only thing they could do, they got hosed. They sold $1 billion too cheaply. That's the least important part. This is what's the most important is what they lost in their ability to run the city. For now, for the remaining 60 some odd years of the contract of the deal, if the city wants to eliminate parking spots, either for a street fair for a weekend, but more importantly for bus rapid transit, for transit, for bike lanes, for street malls, they got to buy the spots back. So think about the things a city does: land use, housing, environment, transportation, sort of really fundamental municipal responsibilities. That, the city council and the mayor's hands are tied. They don't do those things.
This dynamic reminds me of the investor dispute resolution mechanisms in stuff like NAFTA and in the TPP deal, where essentially the sovereignty of the in this case the city has been basically sold, and so they're going to have to pay. 75 years from now, hopefully we have hovercrafts and we don't need these parking spaces, or this is a pedestrian mall, like you say, or whatnot. And none of this can happen without the city paying this exorbitant penalty, essentially. And that gives, that opens up, I think.
And let me say that kind of to your question, why is this the right story to start with? It's a terrible deal. Everybody knows it was a terrible deal. But it gets at the heart of this. And this is a handing of control, handing of our democratic rights, our ability to make decisions to private interests. That's the most important lesson. And we see that throughout in all sorts of privatization of all sorts of stuff.
Well, let's talk about what do we mean when we say privatization? Because there's I think different people have different senses of what that means. And maybe you need to answer too is simultaneously. Again, what do we mean by public goods or public services?
Sure. I have a very specific definition of privatization that I use, and it's, I'll mention it and then I'll describe it. So it's private control over public goods. So let me elaborate. Private control happens in a bunch of ways, you know, over the things that matter to us. Outsourcing, for sure. Private prisons, private parking meters, you know, water systems, just, you know, custodial services are outsourced and, you know, in school systems and school districts and things like that. All that's definitely, you know, handing over control because it's all got contracts, right? The contract becomes paramount. But I also believe that it's also about austerity. When we cut taxes and we don't have enough public revenue for things that we all need, like college, like childcare, like, you know, things that are essentials for all of us to survive, then we're kind of left in the market to fend for ourselves, right? It also, you know, when we don't have the resources to oversee and to monitor, you know, the laws that we pass around, you know, food safety, say we have laws and, you know, we should be monitoring those, you know, processing lines of chickens and lettuce and all those things. Companies monitor themselves and bad things happen because they're, you know, they either, you know, they cut corners or they hire external monitors that are responsible to the people paying to them. So they don't look for everything. So it's, you know, there's a set of, and then, so, you know, we also, when we don't adequately regulate something like the air, right, and we don't monitor when we do regulate, then again, we're giving control of the things that are essential to us, clean air and the environment and the planet, to private interests that have real clear, you know, purpose.
And we should say that when we hand these things over, their incentive structure is very often divergent from the rest of ours, right? I mean, it is, regardless of what government does, it is redistributing society's wealth in one form or another. And this really is just comes down to a question of, like, who's going to get it? Is it going to be spread around to the greatest number of people, both in terms of, you know, I guess you could say in terms of financial wealth and in terms of political power, or is it going to be reserved for a narrow subset of people? And that's basically what it comes down to.
That's right. And it's not just wealth. It's also the stuff. It's the wealth and the what we need. I didn't get to the part about the public goods. The way I define it is not, I define it differently than the economics textbooks define it. I won't get into that now, but it's the stuff we all need to survive. Number one, health, education, knowledge, democracy, you know, mobility, clean water, all that stuff. And they also happen to be the things that we can only do if we do them together because we are interdependent. So it's, we're transferring wealth when we privatize, but we're also transferring authority over those fundamentals. So I think that's really important to understand.
Let's go through some of the examples that you lay out in your book. I mean, you go through at least a dozen, I guess, pretty close, of sort of major sectors and aspects of our lives, I guess, that have been privatized. Let me put it this way. I mean, I do want to cover, you know, most of these. But from your perspective, what has been the most, I guess, problematic privatization? Which sector is most problematic that you recount? Let's say over, and much of this has happened, particularly, I guess now over the past 40 some odd years, as, you know, sort of a neoliberal push sort of has emerged, I should say. But what do you think, what sector has been the most problematic or is there one?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of like asking me to choose my, you know, which child I like best, right? Let me answer it. I mean, there's a lot of horrors, right? Private prisons are horrible and things like that. But let me, I'll answer in this way. My favorite section of the book is the section on community. And it's interesting. We talk about schools. We talk about parks. We talk about libraries. We talk about Social Security because that's a community of the whole. So I'll answer it in that way. I think because it's the bigger impact. Let me focus on public education. So we are seeing right now, both in the growth of vouchers around the country, mostly in red states, but also the growth of charter schools, which are publicly funded, privately operated. There's good charters and bad charters, and that debate kind of goes off in that direction, unfortunately, too often. And what we're seeing is, you know, the dismantling of creating a two or three parallel education systems, right? We're turning us as, you know, we're moving from a public service into a competitive environment, you know, it's a market good, right? Where charter schools are competing for our kids and our families for, you know, for their dollars and their attendance, right? Because the public dollars come with the kids. So I'm saying at the larger level here, so, and I can give lots of examples of that, but what's really important about that is it's dividing us as a nation increasingly. It's making us consumers as opposed to citizens. You know, consumers, if you're a parent right now, my kids are older now, but if you're a parent, as you are, you're going to look for the best school for your kid, period. There's no, you can't ask a parent to do anything else. But the more we turn parents into, but what's important to understand, though, is that parents are now competing and schools are competing against each other. And they're segregating and stratifying in ways that may make sense for the family. You know, you're picking what looks best for you, but it's dividing us. It's making us not be, you know, in the same places, right? It's not, you know, if you're not connecting, if you're not integrating, if you're not experiencing the public things together like you would in a park or a school when I grew up, or a library and these other public things, you know, we're hurting the country and we're hurting democracy in profound ways.
And we should say, I mean, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about charter schools over the past, 15 years or so. And the I don't have a problem per se with the concept of charter schools, but this is a way of just basically also draining money from the public. And we saw this with Betsy DeVos. Betsy DeVos and her husband were interviewed and they specifically said, we don't have a problem with public education. We just have a problem with public schools. The idea being that we want the money to come into the public education coffers, but then we want to be able to distribute. In their instance, I think they wanted it really for parochial schools, for religious schools, but they also wanted to be able to privatize portions of it. And the fact is you're going to leave behind large segments of the population who are going to get a substandard education because the money is going to be drained out of the system.
That's right. There's something also really important about that, about the charter schools. I mean, you know, they're good charter. I mean, the problem with charter school debate is are you for them or against them? It's completely useless and, you know, discussion. The issue is the original idea of charters is good. Create laboratories of innovation, learn new things, create some, you know, environments where that can happen, but then share, right? So that everyone can benefit from that. That's not what it is anymore. Now it's become a market good. And so, and you get the distortions that come with markets. So what happens? Schools are now, you know, they're referred to as creaming and cropping, that are, you know, charter schools are figuring out ways, even though it's illegal in most cases, to either not enroll or push out kids that are more expensive, that are harder to educate. And that's going on all over the place. You know, you may have read it in New York, there was a principal that had a quote, got to go list. And it was just, you know, figuring out how to push out those kids. And that happens, you know, all over the place. But the other thing is private in the market, competitors don't share, right? A number of teachers in a number of charter schools around the country have to sign NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, that prevent them from sharing the school's trade secrets. What are those trade secrets? Lesson plans, curriculum, teaching methods. So, you know, when you took a good idea and you turned it into a market good, that's what's the problem with charter schools.
And so when you talk about that section on community, this is really about the sort of the stratification that it creates in the context of our citizenry. And when you have multiple different sort of destinies or fates for people in the context of a society, it becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy in many respects.
That's right. Why would you, you know, want to pay taxes if all you need is what you need? You know, if you don't trust anybody else, if you think that's, you know, the money you're going to spend is going to help somebody else and not us. So I think the division, that, you know, one of the things I say is a privatized America is a divided America. And, you know, we could talk for a long time about division America, particularly this week.
Yes, exactly. Well, let's talk about the at one point you cover science and research, public science and research. We're seeing, you know, both a whole well, we have three major vaccines that were developed with you know, to some extent or another, huge public investment. Same with the Pfizer pill, essentially the therapy for COVID. How widespread is this? I mean, do we have much by way of private scientific, I guess, achievement that is not funded by the public in some fashion or another?
I don't believe so, and I can't speak universally just to our research. So an interesting thing about the vaccines that I find interesting is that, you know, the reason that it was sequenced so quickly, the virus, you know, a couple of years back now, is in great part because of the massive investment in the Human Genome Project in the 90s, which was basic science. It wasn't applied science. And what happened with all that money and all that research is that the technology got developed, I'm sure publicly and privately, figuring out how to do it, to sequence genes. And that's how we sequence it so quickly and how we're sequencing the variant so quickly. So there's both massive, you know, there's basic science that we invest in, which is vital, right? That's not directed by profit or, you know, a product. And then there's also, as you mentioned, there's lots of investment just in the stuff itself. You know, we gave Moderna a grant. We gave Pfizer a pre-buy agreement. Johnson & Johnson, I don't recall. But, you know, you can do this. I mean, first off, we don't want people to have to pay for it. So you have to have public money involved. If you, again, that gets to this point. We now know that, you know, the health of all of us depends on the health of each of us. You know, that's a lesson from COVID. So basically mean everybody's got to have it. You can't do that if it's the markets determining who gets. You got to have public. Now, you know, the hospital, I got my last shot at CVS. That's fine. But I didn't pay for it because it's a public essential.
We haven't all learned that lesson from COVID, I should say, sadly, but that is the case. Talk about the justice system. I had no idea. I mean, I have a sense of the privatization in the form of arbitration and in many respects, sort of closing the courtroom doors. I had no idea like what was going on with Georgia, where you got to pay to find out what the law is.
Well, there's a good answer. I mean, ultimately that got overturned, but I'll tell the story, you know, after we wrote the book. So this goes to, you know, austerity. You know, the state of Georgia, I'll give the facts a little bit of the context. There's the state code, the official code of Georgia, but there's also another code that's the official code of Georgia annotated. Okay. The annotated code is the only accurate one because it's got the updates of amendments and judicial, the results of legal cases and things like that. The state didn't want to pay for that anymore, access to that anymore, maintaining it and providing free access. So they outsourced it. They gave it to LexisNexis. Okay, so now what used to be, and in my sense, probably yours as well, what should be available to everyone, the ability to know what the law is, right? That's sort of fundamental to democracy. Now you got to pay for it. Okay, well, you know, before you had to pay for it, and a fair amount of money. It was like $400 for a CD, or I can't remember, a CD and pay, you know, you got to pay. Okay, and then the kicker was they copyrighted it. I mean, it became a private good. You know, copyright, the copyright was owned by LexisNexis. So, you know, good government activists, you know, they took it and they made it available, you know, for everybody. They broke the law, I guess, the copyright law. Ultimately, it came out good for them and us. But that's the instinct. Turn a public good, an essential public good, into a private commodity.
What is driving this? I mean, I guess there's two sides of this ledger, right? Is the implications of it and the incentive structure. The incentive structure, it just seems to me, for the most part, is people want to make money, and so they come and pitch this, and some level of corruption in the context of government on whatever level it is. And some level of like ideological, I guess, influence on government, which is that we exist as a society only for some people to make a lot of money.
Yeah, well, no, that's a great point. Great question. I think you got it right. So first off, important to recognize, it's businesses do one thing. They sell things and they see a market. You know, before COVID, and right now it's more, but before COVID, we were spending, governments in America, from local to federal, were spending about $7 trillion a year. Okay, you're running a private prison corporation. What do you want? You want that, there was $100 billion there. You want a piece of it. So there's just, this is all about sales, for a big push. The second, it's corruption, but you mentioned corruption, but it's also just, you're running a city and someone comes to you and says, cheaper, better, faster. I can take a problem off your hands. Leads into the ideological is, okay, well, that's, I'll get rid of this thing. Maybe I have a relationship with them, but maybe not, but maybe it sounds good. But it's also because there is this embedded belief ideologically that, the market's probably better anyway. Private sector is more efficient. The public sector is not. I can get rid of workers. I can do a set of things. So I think, they're in a sea of pro-market ideology and anti-government ideology that has been, we've been, bombarded with for the last 40 years. And that's kind of embedded deeply in governance at all levels.
When you're making the case that there is a problem with privatization, what do you deploy? What's more important to deploy here, I guess? Is it the argument that many times this is not really ultimately the most efficient way of doing this? Because, just whether you look at our response to Hurricane Katrina, where you had contractors who contracted out to other contractors to get those buses to come to New Orleans that day, and they kept them, in the parking lots 3 hours away because they didn't want to waste money. If it wasn't absolutely necessary and then they were too late, or is the argument one about the more ideological one that is more about maintaining democracy and a greater, a more democratic control over the goods and services that we need and have as a society?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll just say on the efficiency part, I'll bookmark that because it just turns out not to be true. And there's, it's worth peeling into that. So, but I'll set that aside. I think it's definitely the democratic, the idea that we should democratically be able to determine what everybody gets, number one, and we should be able to set standards for health, for the environment, for economy, for all those public essentials. Is the most important thing that we can decide, not the market can decide. Now, it doesn't mean that the public does everything. There's private and everything, right? Private contractors build the roads. There's, it's sort of all of the above. But the question of who's in charge are on the essentials. And either we deliver it, we provide it and public it like in public schools, or we regulate it and make sure that it's living up to those standards and make sure we cops on the beat, as it were, to make sure that those standards are, are enforced and lived up to. That's the most important thing that we need to, if we want to pivot American society and politics, we need to go there.
Let's talk about the efficiency, because there is this, I guess, and which I, I think you would argue also is a false belief that it's just simply more efficient, that private enterprise can move more efficiently. I don't know how anybody who has ever worked in any type of large corporation can actually believe this. What do we have a sense of is there data on this?
I don't know if there's large data on that, but I'll peel into it in a different way. So first off, big organizations are complex. big government, big corporations are complex, lots of bureaucracy. So let's just set that aside, right? There's lots of examples of they say they'll do it cheaper and they end up not being able to do it cheaper. So that's the thing. But what's really important to understand is when folks say we can do it more efficiently, what it really means is they can do it cheaper, right? More, you know, less expensively. Okay, so it's really important to ask the question, okay, means you're going to spend less on something. What? Tell us exactly what you're going to spend less on, because it's not an infinite number of possibilities. It's quite finite. Let's say a prison, right? Fewer corrections officers, and they do that. You know, there was a prison in Mississippi, I think a juvenile detention facility in Mississippi, that went from 1 to 12 staff to inmate ratio to 1 to 60. You know, bad things happen when you do that. You could pay them less, you know, pay and working, you know, wages and benefits and all that, which they do, and that creates higher turnover. And there's sort of, impacts of all these things. So you can do that. You could use, not as high quality stuff, you know, food. You could have lower quality food, which prisons have done. And that creates more dangerous prisons. There was maybe closer to you in Michigan and Ohio, you know, it was outsourced. Their food services were outsourced to Aramark. They lowered the quality of the food. There were found maggots in the food. There are two things that you need to make sure you have clear to make prisons not be dangerous. And that is access to phones and good food. Those are the key. The people in corrections tell me. So that's what efficiency means, right? To serve less, because again, on the flip side of that, we have to remember when a private company comes in, they have to pay their investors, you know, their shareholders. They have much higher CEO, you know, executive compensations. They do lobbying and campaign contributions. They do have debt service because they're buying up other companies. So they have all these other costs that are every dollar of those things are things that are of those costs are dollars that are not going into the service. Right. So that, I mean, I do this because that's efficiency is real simple. Less in for more out. And that's not what happens.
And they have just a another line item, which is shareholder profits, company profits, but that it just comes off the top.
That's exactly right. And, you know, when they privatized Medicaid, you know, they did in Iowa and Kansas. It's just real simple. It's, you know, it's money. You know, you're going to say you're going to do it cheaper. What are you going to do? You're going to give less care. And that's exactly what happened.
So what is how we can fight back part of the equation here? I mean, what is, whether it's, over the past couple of years, we've seen pushes to privatize our parks, and we're seeing it now with libraries. I know you've written about that as well. What can we do? Is the fight a local fight? Is it a national fight? Is it a federal fight, or just simply an ideological one?
Yes. So I'll go through each one. So at the local level, they're going to privatize a park, they're going to privatize a library and all that. The most important thing is to ask questions, right? Before, like Chicago, that's why I say Chicago is a cautionary tale. No questions were asked, right, beforehand. Questions like, all right, they say they're going to make money, right? Well, why can't we make that money, number one? And how much are they going to make, and how much are they going to take, and how much of the meters prices, as you know, went way up? And what decisions are we not going to be able to make because we've signed a legally binding contract? Crucially important, you know, in libraries, what's going to happen to the book collection? Who's going to be able to make the decisions about, you know, the diversity of what's in the stuff you can take out? So most important to ask those hard questions and connect them to the larger public purpose, right? Parking meters. I mean, let's set aside parking meters. Transportation, you know, roads. Roads are about mobility, right? Roads are about, we need to move around. So if we privatize a road that has a non-compete clause in it, meaning you can't build mass transit that competes with it, what's that going to do to our ability to, you know, move people around and move? So that's the first thing. At the ideal, and number two is we set standards, right? And that can be done at the federal, state, and local level. You know, we estimate that there's about $2 trillion of spending, all levels of government, on procurement, on buying goods and services. That gives us a lot of power to set standards to make sure those things are done well, the jobs, the quality, et cetera, et cetera. We should be setting standards for every and implying those standards to everything we do, every decision, every land use decision at a local level, every federal spending or regulatory decision at the federal level. And then I'll just one last thing about sort of the ideas.
So in other words, just when you're talking about procurement, those contracts come with strings.
Absolutely. Right. They should. We should, you know, there's...
And we see that in the context of federal contractors need to maintain a higher minimum wage. The Biden administration attempted to do it also with vaccine mandates, with non-discrimination issues. And we can be more... We can make those more extensive and
more extensive, more aggressive, and more direct. And but remarking that it's, you know, remembering and putting at the center of that what it's about. Why do you raise the wages of the contractors? Well, first off, because we are driving inequality. If we're paying for $2 trillion worth of stuff, and there's a couple million people that are making less than $12 an hour, that one study found, we are creating more equality with our public dollars and our public decisions. So it's really important. Inequality, climate, racism, the big stuff, that's what these decisions are all about. All right. And we should make sure that every one of those decisions does that. You know, so absolutely. I mean, the last part, the ideological part is, I think it's really important for all of us to, you know, we say it in the book, surface the state around us. Right. We're not always necessarily clear about the role of the public all around us. You turn on the water and, you turn on the tap and the water comes out. It's kind of a miracle, I think. It's a public service. You know, the paint on our walls used to have lead in it. It doesn't because of a public action, regulatory action. And so it's important for us to recognize that and raise that up to remember the public purpose of that. Health, safety, the essentials, the public goods.
What is the this notion of a submerged state is I think is huge, frankly, because I don't think there's a way. The classic cry of, get the government's hands off my Medicare, that type of thing. What needs to happen in that instance? I mean, I would imagine on some level it's also just a function of like. Maybe we need more civics back in our schools on some level, but we also need our politicians to remind people. I mean, this seems to be an ideological problem that we've had, frankly, with the Democratic Party, because you had people like Bill Clinton, and there was a story out today, I guess, by ProPublica about the abject failure of his welfare reform. And we've talked about that for years around here, but the ideological notion of, a leaner, a government that is not an obstacle is completely, wrong from an ideological perspective, but it's also 180 degrees upside down from what the reality is. Nothing would happen in our society without what our government has either done or is doing, in any given moment.
That's exactly right. It's the politicians, it's the opinion class, as it were. I guess we're all a part of that, right? It's a whole lot easier to complain about stuff, right? And we're in an environment, and like we said earlier, that we're in a 40, 50 year environment of anti-government attacks. That stuff is deeply embedded in us, right? And then, those of us that have been advocates for many years, you get so far, but you don't get all the way. And there's a tendency not to celebrate the stuff we won because we're thinking about what we left behind, the part we didn't get. Right. So I think there's a part of us that comes back to us, the active class, the active, in folks in movements and organizations and things like that. It's all of the above.
Well, the book is The Privatization of Everything, How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America and How We Can Fight Back. It was co-written with Alan McCallion. Donald Cohen will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half of the program. We're going to take your phone calls at 646-257-3920. A reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget about Just Coffee. JustCoffee.coop. It's a cooperative in Madison, Wisconsin. They not only run their business, and their business is a co-op, but they're also incredibly helpful to the farms that they buy from, whether that's in Central America or Latin America. They have a great relationship with those folks, and the coffee's great. And you can also get the Majority Report blend. So win-win. And if you use the coupon Majority, you get 10% off. So check it out, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. What else? Oh, if you go to Majority Live now, you will see that the live show has been updated May 15th at 2 p.m. Some seats, a couple of seats have opened up. Still have some seats on the mezzanine, did you say? And up top level, up for the Wilba in Boston, Massachusetts. And so check that out. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian Media Universe?
Tonight we'll be doing a Left Reckoning, 8 Eastern, 7 Central. We'll be talking about Aaron Rodgers being an Atlas Shrugged reader, and if you should be too. And also we'll talk a little bit about Tim Kaine in the snow lane and what it means for American infrastructure. So that's tonight, 8 o'clock Eastern, patreon.com/Left Reckoning.
We have a great clip from, what's her name? I can't remember her name now. I can't hear you. Dana Perino, right, yeah. I mean, during the Bush administration, we always thought that Bush was the dumb one. But she is making a case that, in fact, as his spokesperson, she also had no clue what was going on. But we will play that clip in just a moment. Also, before we head into the fun half, I will read you this. Just because occasionally we get emails from listeners, and I always want to read them if they're apropos. This comes from I don't know if she's a listener, Danielle. Maybe she saw it on YouTube. What the fuck do you mean, cancel Jimmy? The subject line was Jimmy Dore. Did we ever say we were going to cancel Jimmy? How do we cancel? Can we cancel? I would cancel him. If I was in charge of programming, I would cancel.
I mean, yeah, I don't think we think he's worth the attention. Is that canceling?
Oh, no, no.
People's audience, you know. He's worth our attention.
Yeah, without a doubt. You sound exactly like the self-serving, righteous, undemocratic prick of an idiot you are. Now, I think that's a way of saying that I'm authentic. Right? I mean, I should sound exactly like I am. I'm not sure I totally agree that it's undemocratic to say that Jimmy Dore is an idiot. I'm not sure I find that, but I mean, as a Jimmy Dore listener, I would imagine that there's some things that might be a little bit challenging to express. You know, Jimmy would have been canceled long ago if it were up to a-holes like you, but he's not. Know why? Because it's up to us, not you. And canceling you is up to us too. Remember that, in all caps. I would just say, like, when you say it's up to us to cancel Jimmy or not, I would say I'm part of that us. I'm not part of the us that would cancel me. That's you and Jimmy. But, I mean, I'm part of the us that could cancel Jimmy if Jimmy was going to be canceled. I just wanted to read that just because I thought it was funny. You know, you send me an email with all caps, there's a good chance, or, you know, at different points, there's a good chance I'm going to read it on air, just because it's, that's my jam. Matt!
It'd be very funny to ask if we did a video titled Cancel Jimmy, asking people to please cancel Jimmy Dore, not just, like, you know, saying this thing he said about vaccines is silly.
Right, right. Folks, please cancel Jimmy Dore. Cancel him. I don't know. I don't know exactly what that means, but cancel him. Have him canceled. Cancel. There's a bunch of people I would cancel. But I only say that because I got the email.
Did we cancel Dave Rubin?
Did we cancel Dave Rubin? We tried.
Is that what we did to him?
We just defined him. We defined him. That's all I'm really interested in defining Jimmy as well. Let's go. Let's see. Crab, Salt, and Cracker says, part of Jimmy's rant you didn't play yesterday included him mentioning six-figure MSNBC contracts when calling people like TYT, Sean, and et cetera for being CIA. He's too scared to even mention Sam by name. Well, he was not referring to me if he's talking about a six-figure MSNBC contract. I will tell you that my MSNBC contract has been worth not quite three figures. In this past year, it's sort of contingent upon when I go on. I haven't been on MSNBC, I think, in a year. The Peacock thing has been over for 4 or 5 months now, I guess, 3 or 4 months. But I still have a three-figure deal with MSNBC, so that may come in handy soon. We're going to take a quick break, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Bring back DJ Dinner.
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what? What? Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am in total.
Pussy.